WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Basically, the theory here is pretty simple, which is they said to me, who do you want to have a conversation about China with? And I said, Rick Larson. And they said,
who?
Is he good? I've known Congressman Rick Larson for a while. I used to see him when I was based in China, and he would come over on government business. Larson represents a district in western Washington state, north of Seattle. Since 2005, he's been the co-chair of something called the U.S.-China Working Group, so he knows as much about China trade issues as anyone in Congress.
We're trying, you know, sort of the mantra since 2005, since we started it, is that, you know, we'll take panda huggers, we'll take dragon slayers, and we'll even take panda slayers.
So, you know, panda huggers and dragon slayers are the two species of relationships that people have with China. And I run into this all the time in Washington. Those are essentially the categories, right?
Yeah. I try to, because I spend a lot of time on thinking about this, people think I'm a panda hugger, if you will, that, you know, Rick Larson's a friend of China. Well, I don't mind being a friend of China if it's in the U.S. interest to do that, because I think it is in the U.S. interest to engage with China on even on issues that are difficult for us.
When President Trump was on the campaign trail, China featured fairly prominently in his talk about America and about America's place in the world. How much of what he said as a candidate has become what he's doing as president?
My assessment would be so far not as much as he said as a candidate.
From your perspective, is that good or bad?
Oh, yeah. I think that's good. You know, the president, as a candidate, said he wanted to designate China a currency manipulator. He threatened tariffs of, you know, 45% on Chinese goods and so on, which, according to one study I saw, my district would have been impacted negatively the most.
Why would your district have been impacted so heavily?
We have a small airplane manufacturing facility in the district called Boeing.
Right.
So 23,000 people a day who live in my district work at that facility, and another 7,000 come to work in my district from outside the district. So 30,000 people plus spouses build airplanes in my district. And China and the Chinese airlines are major purchasers of those airplanes. So the point being that the president's threats of tariffs in order to get what he believes America wants out of the Chinese relationship would have had a disastrous negative economic effect.
I think, you know, by now, at the moment where we are in our politics, we have a feeling for how China looks to Americans in the Rust Belt, for instance. How does it feel to somebody who's in a place where jobs have disappeared, and oftentimes the way it's described is that they went to China, whether they actually ended up there or not. But how does it feel to people in your area? It sounds like it's a very different image around China.
Yeah, it is very different, and it shows the breadth and diversity of opinion in the United States. And you're absolutely right in saying so, and I hear this from colleagues from the Midwest. You know, every job that U.S. that's lost in the U.S. or in their area went to China, every last one of them. You know, the numbers show that's very different. The numbers show automation and technology have a lot to do with job loss, because at the same time, we've actually increased jobs in the country. We've increased productivity. But, you know, where I'm from in the Pacific Northwest, the first steamship that called in the port of Seattle back in the late 1800s was out of Hong Kong. And we have a very long economic relationship as a state with the Chinese mainland. And I tell folks, they say, well, you need to come to my district and see what is done. And I say, yeah, and you need to come to my district and see as well.
Have you formed a sense of which relationship with China is in fact the more typical one for how it's affecting the United States? Is it your district or is it the district that you hear about from people in the Midwest?
Oh, yeah. That's, I think, the more typical relationship that's impacting policy has to do with the more challenging aspects of the relationship. Where people are hurting most, that ends up driving policy. And getting back to your question about the president as a campaigner, I think he was reflecting that anxiety about job loss and finding the boogeyman, if you will, to point at, and China was the most obvious. And again, I think he's backing off of that as a president.
So how would you describe what the administration is trying to do? As far as you can tell, what are their priorities when it comes to really building the relationship with China?
I think on the economic side, I think there's a step backwards a little bit in this administration. Whereas the Obama administration and the Bush administration both sort of looked at a more comprehensive and strategic relationship with China, this administration so far seems to be taking more of a transactional relationship with China on economics. You know, you give us beef and we'll give you this. You give us pork and we'll
literally
give you this.
Literally beef, in the sense literally, beef exports, right?
Literally beef exports, literally pork exports, as opposed to thinking more broadly about, you know, market access for non-Chinese companies to get into the Chinese market.
Is there something wrong with a transactional approach like that?
I think it leaves a lot on the table for the United States. And there's a lot that the United States can offer on climate change. That's pointing out the Paris Agreement puts China at the forefront of climate change. But the value of the Paris Agreement for the United States was the opportunity it would have given U.S. businesses to go into China and help China solve its environmental problems. You know, look, I believe in climate change. I believe it's human cause. I believe the Paris Agreement was a good deal, but it was going to be a great economic deal for U.S. businesses. And now the opportunity is lost because we pulled out of the Paris Agreement.
In April, President Trump met with Xi Jinping for the first time in Mar-a-Lago and came out of it with a very positive impression. He talks about the fact that they had good chemistry and so on. Do you get the sense that the U.S.-China relationship is now in the mode that the president thinks it is? Do you get the sense that the Chinese are looking at President Trump the way that he's looking at them?
No, I don't think that they look at each other the same way. I was asked earlier this year if I thought this, it's important to have a real good relationship between the two leaders. And they said, yes, it is, but we can't rely on the good relationship of two leaders to have a good relationship. We need to actually have reasons to have a good relationship that go beyond the individual personalities. And I think that the administration maybe being a little too transactional with the Chinese leadership, I think plays more into the Chinese hands than it does in the U.S. hands. The Chinese leadership wants a transactional relationship because then it means they don't need to worry about democracy. They don't have to worry about human rights. They don't have to worry about America talking about these issues that have been important to our foreign policy in the past. I think it is one more missed opportunity if we don't at least continue talking about human rights in a way that says that we're serious about it. For a lot of our faults, which are our responsibility to own, a lot of these countries want the United States to continue to stand up for these values that we've always stood up for, that have been part of our foreign policy for well over 100 years.
There is sometimes a dramatic cast to the kind of discussion about the U.S.-China relationship. People will compare it to the years before World War I, when you had great powers that were intertwined economically and found themselves almost, the term is sleepwalking, into a conflict with each other, simply because they weren't alert enough to the risks that could trigger a war. Yeah. How much do you worry about the idea that the United States and China, even though we have these great interdependencies, could in fact find ourselves in a conflict?
Yeah, I believe it's called the Thucydides trap. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, don't ask me who Thucydides is. He's some Greek guy in the Peloponnesian War.
Hey. I've been told he was a historian who wrote about the idea that a rising power and an incumbent power will always get into a conflict. Right?
Yeah, that's right. And I don't agree with that necessarily applies in this case, because it is a different time. Miscommunication has to be part of Thucydides' trap. China is a rising power. It is investing much more in its military. It's investing in fifth-generation aircraft, fighter aircraft. It's investing in intelligence and electronics and so on. It's doing things that you'd kind of expect a large country to do. I think that we, the United States, needs to be careful about interpreting what that means.
So you've traveled around the region. The United States has pulled out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
How is that being received? How is that being felt? Are other countries looking at the United States differently as a result?
Yeah, it hasn't played well. You know, whether we like it or not, TPP became a symbol. It wasn't just a trade agreement. It became a symbol of the U.S. commitment to the region. Now, we have there's a strong U.S. commitment to the region, and it continues. It's largely based now in our military presence. So what does that leave it? Well, it leaves us with, on TPP specifically, the other 11 countries exploring whether or not to do a TPP 11.
TPP 11 meaning essentially the TPP without the United States.
Yeah, the 11 other countries that were going to be partners in TPP. So with Japan saying that they want to do that, then it sort of gives it some momentum. China and a few other countries are working on a separate trade agreement called RCEP, Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. And it's a regional trade agreement essentially that China has led, but the standards are much lower than they would have been under TPP. And this is important because it's setting the rules of the road for trade between these countries, rules of the road that if the United States was involved, would be much higher standards. We'd be able to push for labor standards and trade agreements, be able to push for environmental standards and trade agreements. And now those fall by the wayside if this RCEP ends up becoming the standard. A lot of the things that Americans build, and we still build a lot of things, end up in the hands of a growing middle class in these Asian countries.
Things like what? Like high-end electronics and stuff like that?
Yeah, and again, it's not just airplanes, but it is high-end electronics. It's manufacturing equipment, large manufacturing equipment coming out of the Midwest. It's any number of consumer products, any number of heavy-duty machinery, appliances. The United States represents only about 5% of the total population of the world. We're not going to buy everything that we make, that Americans make. We have to get into these markets. A trade agreement without us is going to give everyone else the opportunity to get ahead of us. I think the second thing is it gets back to something I really believe, and that's the most, I've heard the most iconic image in the United States is still the Statue of Liberty. Still is. Everybody knows what it is, and everybody knows what it stands for. And that set of values that it stands for, the United States is really the only country that can get into these other countries and explain what those values are and what they mean. If we're not hanging around with these other countries, they're going to either forget that or they're going to wonder where we went. And that has a direct impact then on having friends. Having friends when you need them, having allies when you need them.
Congressman Larson, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming by. I appreciate it.
That was Rick Larson, U.S. Representative from the 2nd District of Washington.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.